Welcome to Holden Village's Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Educational Network and Support. The subject of this evening's session is Naming the Unnamed Pressures on Ministry, with our speaker being Dr. Hartung. Let's listen in.
Good evening. I'm pleased to be able to introduce tonight's presenter, a colleague in ministry, Dr. Bruce Hartung. He's the Director of Ministerial Health, and Healing Ministries of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I suppose I could stop there, but you know, even St. Paul went to great lengths to establish his credentials as an apostle, so let me say a little bit more to show you how eminently he's qualified to speak on the subject that he will be tonight and in the coming days. He's also maintains a clinical psychology practice at Lutheran Child and Family Services of Southern Illinois in Belleville. And prior to his current appointment, Dr. Hartung was the executive director of the Onondaga Pastoral Counseling Center in Syracuse, New York. And then from 1973 to 1983, Dr. Hartung was the director of Parkside Pastoral Counseling Center, connected with Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. He's a clinical psychologist in Illinois, a diplomate in the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, a clinical member of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and a member of the Association of Mental Health Administrators, past president of the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, and has taught at Northwestern University, Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, and Loyola University of Chicago. He's the treasurer of the People's Skills Institute, the treasurer of Anton Boyson Fund Board, and he's chair of the National Pastoral Care Week Committee, which helps in the celebration of Pastoral Care Week, the last full week of October of every year. He's married, has two grown children, and he lives in Manchester, Missouri. Tonight's topic is Naming the Unnamed Pressures on Ministry. It sounds like a real lively group here tonight, Bruce, so good luck. Join me in welcoming Dr. Hartung.
Thank you very much. I have a continuing education goal to move into the 20th century before we go into the 21st. And part of that is to use a laptop computer in which is part of my presentation tonight. Now, the good news is that it's in here. The bad news is where? But I think I'm all right. There's a little piece of it that I need, and come on now, do something. If not, we'll just not have that piece, and that'll probably be all right also. Now let's see, why isn't it going forward? Oh, I'm into timed backup now. This is cute. Actually, this is going to work. There it is. I understand that this is the time that we bring out the round tables and the beer. Wasn't that what Tim Law suggested that we do? Well, John? Oh, and I wanted to give you my name tag so you don't assess me. 75 cents. I alternate between narcissistic frenzy and terror when I come to you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and it is a thrill, actually, even though I have a lot of anxiety about a large group such as this. I tend to be more comfortable in smaller groups, and I've never quite been able to manage large group dynamics. So if you can just sort of, be gentle. I do hope that, however, that as I vacillate between thinking that I have something that's relevant to say and thinking that I have nothing relevant to say, as I vacillate between those two poles, that somewhere in the middle we'll try to find something that is at least appreciably relevant and in some ways, I hope, helpful to the health and well-being of we who are professional church workers, our spouses if we're married, and our families if there is family. By way of introduction, I'd like to tell you that I've spent the bulk of my professional life in a ministry of pastoral counseling, as you heard, first in the Chicago area and most recently in upstate New York. Conversations that led to my call to St. Louis to be the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's first director of ministerial health came to me as quite a shock. I have zero tolerance for bureaucratic structure. I've never left adolescence and never appropriately worked out my adolescent rebellion. I've always liked to be where the action is. While I've been active in administrative positions in both contexts of my ministry, I generally have believed that less is better and administration must always lead to action or go out of business. So when I got this call to the Synod, my friends were absolutely amazed that I would get it in the first place with the general phrase, the Synod has lost its marbles. And they were amused when I considered it, Hartung has lost his marbles, or anxious, he's going to get lost and get chewed up. But the interesting thing about it was the opportunity to work in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod bureaucracy was such an odd call and so outlandish that I needed to take it seriously. And it was the outlandishness that brought me to St. Louis, back to the Midwest, and the hope and the opportunity to possibly be helpful to the professional church workers of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and maybe others as well. So I began with the LCMS in August of 1991, and I think I've been learning about the LCMS really ever since. So I come to you in a hopeful spirit that we can learn and grow together and that our gracious God will bless our community gathering. I need your help and your feedback to refine and make as accurate as possible what I'll be discussing. This will have a little clinical and sort of organizational psychology kind of note to it. I hope that that's a balance in a way to Tim Lawl's work, and hopefully there will be a way to continue to integrate issues related to ministerial health, the clinical field, and theological discussion. This is a quote from my machine, which better not go blank on me. The cynics are winning. People are fed up. They're angry, disgusted, and pessimistic about their future. Alienation is higher than it's been in a quarter century. Our loyalty to institutions and institutions' loyalty to people is sinking like a stone. No longer would we rather fight than switch. We just switch. Nearly half the population is cynical, and cynics don't participate in changing things. In such a climate, how can a leader, read church leader here, possibly mobilize a seeming unwilling constituency? That is from James Kouza's and Barry Posner's work, The Leadership Challenge, published by Jossie Bass, 1995. That the cynics are winning is one of seven new realities suggested by these two innovative and creative authors for our thoughts concerning the discussion of theology and culture, and assuming that we have the sense of surround of the culture. Here go the others. Power is shifted. It's gone to the people, like computers, with a new relationship being defined as client-server. How do you lead in a client-server world when the so-called management techniques and what I at least grew up in terms of pastoral ministry, was designed essentially to support a master-slave rather than a client-server world? Secondly, we're all connected. How do you lead in a wired world where all information is instant and news is old instantly? Thirdly, knowledge is the new currency. Knowledge added is the most value, is the new value added. How do you lead in a world in which your most important resources go in and out the front door every day? The world is fragmented, parochial. How can a leader unite such a diverse and disparate constituency? There's a new social contract on the table. Loyalty and job security are reduced. We have a new social contract that promises interesting work and greater employability in exchange for commitment to excellence. But how do leaders create commitment in a virtual organization? Can there be such a thing as virtual commitment? Surreality in organizations that themselves are not loyal to people, nor the people loyal to them? How capable are leaders of delivering on the promises implicit in the new contract? And, echoing some of Timothy's work, there is a renewed search for meaning. With all of the above, there's come a yearning for a greater purpose in our lives. As the writers say, as the world erupts with the quakes of change, we seek to calm our fears by searching our souls and reaching out to our companions. How can leaders close the credibility gap and become more like trusted friends? Susan's wonderful homily, I think, or Tim's, somewhere I got that idea. In this increasingly cynical world, one way to look at these issues is to explore out of our own understanding of things how leaders can be healthy and effective as they approach these concerns, and that ought to be done. However, I think that it makes sense to see if it's possible to identify what characteristics people seek in their leaders in the midst of the culture that we experience today with all these changes. And in a study of over 400 case studies spanning almost a decade, Kouzes and Poser suggest that the majority of us admire and willingly follow leaders who are honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent. Honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent. With honesty selected more often than any other leadership characteristic. If we are to follow somebody, or if we are to be followed, to use the old leadership cliches, we want to assure ourselves that the person to be followed is worthy of our trust, if the person has integrity, if the person is truthful, and that's generally judged by behavior rather than by words. People generally won't follow leaders who speak psychobabble but act in unhealthy ways. Nor will they follow leaders that speak theobabble and act in unhealthy ways. Kuzes and Posner put the honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent characteristics together and suggest credibility as a central leadership theme. When led by credible persons, people are significantly more likely to be proud to tell others that they're part of an organization. They feel a strong sense of spirit. They see their own values as consistent with those of the organization. They feel attached and committed to the organization and have a sense of ownership in it. When people perceive their leaders to have low credibility, they are, among other things, likely to say good things about the organization publicly, but criticize it privately and feel unsupported and unappreciated, and a whole underground network emerges of discontent and cynicism. Now, it's hard from my point of view to have serious argument with these characteristics. In the midst of the cynicism of our age, power shifted to the people, connectedness of everybody, knowledge, the new currency, a fragmented world, a new social contract, a renewed search for meaning. We're looking for leaders who are honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent. In many ways, these characteristics are personal ones. In our Lutheran Christian tradition, possibly even spirit-filled results of the action of God, blessed be God's name, through the Christ in our hearts. The community created, the body of Christ, is certainly involved and central. But in the real world, there are characteristics for ourselves concerning which we aspire and often fall short. And I do have some ideas about the falling short part of it. If indeed we strive to be honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent leaders, there are some things in the pressures involved in pastoral ministry, which, for want of a better title, I suggested naming the unnamed ones, that make it hard to be honest, forward-looking, inspiring, and competent leaders. So I'd like to focus a little on those organizational issues in terms of pressures in ministry. Now, since my experience is almost exclusively with the LCMS, and most of you are ELCA, you can say that my experience is with the LCMS, and none of this applies to the ELCA. I hope, however, that you'll still stay, because it will be a problem to my narcissistic exuberance if just everybody leaves. But who really knows? Pressure one. Now, I got to get out of here first. Hang on. Exit. It's blank, is that all right? Done. Pressure one. I recommend a book to you. I'll do that. Donald Sloat. Has anybody read Sloat? I just sort of discovered him. Well, the name of his book is Growing Up Holy or Holy. Holy is H-O-L-Y or Holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y. And the subtitle is New Hope for Adult Children of Evangelicals. The first pressure that I think makes it hard to be honest, using the other terms, credible, the first pressure is holiness versus wholeness. Sloat suggests that there is a significant difference in the adult children of evangelicals. I mean, he uses that language. But. So we're talking now about perhaps adult children of Lutherans, or who knows. Sloat suggests that there is a significant difference between outer forms of piety and the inner reality of what's experienced by the person. And church culture tends to identify as its constituent base the outer form as different than the inner reality. So, if I look pious, I am, even though I may not be. But it's okay with the church if I look pious, because the issue is outer form. If I close my eyes and fold my hands and bow my head, but don't pray, nobody asks what I'm doing. But if I'm praying and a hyperactive at the same time, people think I'm not doing a holy thing. Now, this thing, outer form, inner reality, of what's being experienced, the inner reality around the issues of what's being experienced by the person. In this case, what's being experienced by us as professional church worker types or members, either spouses or children, of professional church worker types. Church culture that focuses on the externals assumes that if the externals are present, the internals are real. And that creates the possibility, perhaps even likelihood, that outer form and behavior become the recognized norm and the inner world of the experience of the person goes untended. Holy, in Sloat's language with an H, is external piety, not necessarily congruent with internal reality. Holy, on the other hand, W-H-O-L-L-Y, is a congruence, more or less, a wholeness between outer form and inner truth. The difference between the inner reality of my world, what I am really feeling and thinking, how my relationships really are with my spouse and my children, the amount of alcohol or medication or sleep or daydreaming or arguing that is really part of my life. The difference between the inner world and the outer presentation of my professional self could be different. I think it's a pressure because it is, in the church culture, expected that there be outer form. And there is limited attention to inner experiential reality. If I pray in public, lead worship, and my shrink self in an understanding and caring way, and model the Christ-like life in terms of what people see, in the church culture, often for professional church workers, that is all that's asked. But the real world for me may be quite different. For all of us, there is a gap between what people see and what our experience really is. The gap between who I know myself to be as a real person, sinner, saint, and who I present myself to be as a clergy person. The gap exists for us all, of course, but, and this is a punchline, I guess, the larger the gap, the more ground there is for disease. The gap exists for us all. Not everybody knows everything about us, nor should they. Well, that would make us have identity boundarylessness, and nobody wants to be that way, nor should they be. But the larger the gap between our actual experience and what it is that we present to folk, the larger that gap, the more opportunity there is for disease. In order to maintain an outer piety that is incongruent with the inner reality, we must learn to obey the following four rules. And those of you in the addiction literature will recognize them. The rules that must be obeyed, that is, if you want to pull off looking very different from what's really going on, you must obey the following rules. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel, and don't want. Only by obeying those rules can the denial mechanisms work. Now, some of you know, a few of you know, as many church workers these days, I come from an alcoholic family. My dad was the alcoholic. We had a wonderful living room. Clean, precise, in order, spectacular. I mean, it's blue collar, but it was spectacular. That's so, whenever anybody came visiting, we're together. We're organized. We're okay. Our living room looks wonderful. Why, we're neat, tidy, clean, godly. My father even drove me to Sunday school every Sunday. Go through the living room, however, through the half-messy dining room, and discover chaos in the kitchen, bedrooms, and basements. The only way to maintain the denial between what it looked like and what it really is to bracket off people's access to what's really happening and obey the don't talk, don't trust, don't feel, don't want rules. Don't talk interferes with communication, promotes dishonesty, prevents intimacy, and inhibits personal growth. Whatever you do, don't say what's really going on in your life to anybody. Don't trust stops attachment and interferes with personal responsibility. Whatever you do, don't trust anybody. Everybody's suspect. Don't feel stops emotional integration and promotes low self-esteem. What I feel is unimportant or even wrong. And don't want interferes with autonomy and impedes emotional development. It says what you want and need, your understanding of yourself, is basically unimportant. All of this creates an internal splitting in which wholeness and health is lost. Hey, this is exciting. That punctuated the point, so I guess I better say it again. Don't feel, don't trust, don't talk, don't want creates an internal splitting, which essentially cuts off communication about what it is that's really happening inside ourselves and what it is that other people know about. On the other hand, wholeness, wellness, health occurs as we disobey these four rules and learn, on the contrary, to talk and trust and feel and want. And how do we learn that? We learn that in spaces and places of real encounter, in cultures of safety that are so, in the body of Christ at least, because they exist in the shadow of the cross, in the love of the Christ, embraced in the arms of the everlasting God. Places of safety are not places of irresponsibility, but there are places of personal revelation. Where are the places in the lives of our congregations where professional church workers are really communicative about themselves. I said this to my colleagues in the LCMS last night, so I will repeat it a little bit. I've just been through a synodical convention for us and some consequent things in which people had different experiences than I did about what was there. And what happens is I have my own thoughts and feelings about this, say, but do I really say them? And I hear all these other things, people saying it was wonderful, great, greatest thing since sliced bread. I begin to think I'm crazy. See? I have an inner experience that I'm not sharing. Other people, the dominant authorities, are saying this is a wonderful thing that's happened. It's just absolutely great, whatever. I'm saying I'm going nuts. My own sense of my ability to perceive, to accurately feel, to understanding what's going on begins to diminish because A, I'm not talking about it very much, and B, other people are attending to a reality that looks different than I see or experience. Ditto for professional church workers, clergy, and parishes. And if you feel at all that there must be a outer form maintained and no or little inner reality communicated of what is really so. Always up, always sensitive, always kind, always pious, always noble. Or to use the organizational words, honest, approachable, credible, all that stuff that I gave you at the beginning. But the issue is, of course, that we, in a fallen world, we aren't that way and can't be. And so what happens with our dishonesty, with our incompetence, with our inflexibility? All that experience that we have that's part of the mixture of who we are as people. So where are places in your life or in mine where the gap narrows? A pastor confessor, a spiritual guide, a therapist, a colleague group, depth friends, fellow pilgrims. Where are the places in your life and mine where the gap widens? Undiscussed secret thoughts, feelings, behaviors. The wider the gap, the more potential there is for disease. The wider the arena for problem growth. And the interesting thing is, the wider the gap, we less and less believe there's a gap. So, I will guarantee you almost, although we in the LCMS don't guarantee anything, I will guarantee you almost that if you're thinking, there's no gap in my life, well, after discussing these ideas with a colleague, he resolved to move in a different direction in his next elders meeting. After opening prayer, it was a particularly cantankerous elders meeting. A group. I mean, it had been cantankerous for several years, right? At his next elders meeting, after opening prayer, but before the beginning of the formal agenda, he asked persons if they would be willing to share something of where they were coming from that evening. That is, something about their inner reality. What was going on in their lives and hearts and minds? 2.5 hours later, the group quietly joined hands and lifted up to the heavens in prayer all that they'd heard. Not one task issue. All what was in people's hearts. Not one business item had been discussed. Rather, the reality of the lives of these people began to be shared and addressed. The dynamic of the group changed. No longer were these people who saw each other as position takers. Rather, they saw each other as persons for whom the Christ died, each struggling through in some way or another their lives. In our lives, places of real encounter, cultures of safety beyond that of our private discussion with God? Where are these? How about the culture of your parish? Is it possible for people through your sermonizing or mine, through our sharing, to know more? And what the people maybe shouldn't know, somebody ought to, in terms of how it really is. The culture can, a holy culture, H-O-L-Y, can mitigate against honest experience. We do have an opportunity as Lutherans who know better than anything else the old and new person business and the ambiguities of life and the fallenness of the creation. We know so much about the gap, really, and how letting that loose in some way in terms of ongoing discussion makes some sense. And that does lead to a second pressure that I'll deal with a little, which is the whole task versus person or role versus being. It laps into the first one. The director of personnel at our mission services, John Mueller, made a statement akin to the following. Oftentimes we ask our people how the task is going, and if it is going well, we assume that all is well. It's the task version of the holy question. If you look holy, everything's okay, and if you're doing your job, everything's okay. Oftentimes the task looks like it's going well, but it is not well for the person. We must learn to ask, says he, how goes it with you? Diane Schief and Anne Fazell, in a wonderful book, The Addictive Organization, familiar with it? Suggests that one problem that especially not-for-profit organizations have, and could churches and parishes be far behind, is that the goals of the organization are valued more highly than the goals of the individual, her or himself, and that more attention is paid to the needs of the organization than the needs of the individuals who serve it. This creates a state of dis-ease and vulnerability as people come to learn experientially that they are useful only to the extent to which they serve the needs of the organization. And when they're no longer providing such service the way the organization desires it, they're abandoned by it. It's an important point. It's an odd situation for the religious community to be in, that is, to value doing the task-fulfilling role above the inherent value of the individual person as a child of God. This is certainly a production mentality and a works orientation of major proportions. Nonetheless, we are especially vulnerable because our sense of mission is so high. Organizations that are addicted to people use people kind of like an alcoholic uses liquor. And so it's not the individual, but the task that needs to be done. So a person can come in, do the task, person moves on, get another person to come in. And so the sequence goes on and on and on. That is task, person, pressure. And the religious community, I think at least, needs to be especially sensitive on this issue. The pressure of this kind of thinking on the church worker is relatively clear. Keep on doing the task the way the organization wants it done, or else you will no longer be of value to the organization and will get somebody else to take your place. This is an issue for which we all organizationally can bear some responsibility. It is, of course, some of our own doing as work righteousness raises its head in all kinds of subtle ways, but it is grace alone that wins the day, huh? Barnabas, an average student at the seminary, was assigned to a parish in a rural area some 60 miles from the nearest Lutheran Church Missouri Synod parish. married with several children, his mid-teens salary plus housing created additional stress upon him and conflict with his spouse. His parish was isolated, used to having a new graduate come in every several years, and was not particularly oriented to growth, openness, hospitality, Bible study, or new pastors. Oriented additionally in a holy mode, H-O-L-Y, son of a church worker who inculcated that into him, as the church worker also beat his child into it. Oriented to keep things inside himself, and himself likely, as I said, abused, our Barnabas felt more and more isolated and sad. Yet he remembered his seminary professor, look for authority wherever you can, saying that one should remain at least several years in one's first parish so that it will look good to the organization and future calling bodies. That is organizational goal. What's important is what the organization thinks is important, not the value of the individual here. Now, I'm, of course, painting this in pretty, you know, bifurcated language. You'll moderate it, right, as you digest some of this. So he stayed and stayed and stayed. Became increasingly isolated, increasingly less able to function, increasingly unappreciated by his congregation, and increasingly stressed in his marital relationship. Soon his congregation wanted to dismiss him because he didn't perform his functions well, as would often be the case as depression becomes more severe. When the extent of his depression was discovered, the new managed care system of Concordia Worker Benefit Plans went into gear. We swung into operation, found a therapist for him. He gets better, but the damage is done in the congregation. They want to rescind, is that what it's called, his call? The good news in this fictional but entirely believable vignette is that good counseling resources were in place. The bad news is significant. He is dismissed from his congregation, placed on restricted status, and the fallout for him and his self-image is that he is not adequate, and the congregation gets a new seminary graduate. I didn't share with you earlier that Arch Hunt's research reported that 70% of his group had a lower self-image after they pastored than when they started. The bad news, the organization continues, people are placed into it, but the parish doesn't look at itself. And the organizational leadership has a difficult time standing up to the parish and saying, whoa, what's going on here? Why? Because the organization's goals are the dominant goals. That is part of our, now remember I'm LCMS, so it may not be true with the LCA. The dominant culture says that the organization's goals are the most important, especially vulnerable in a church context because the mission of salvation is so important. One of the characteristics of all organizations, but especially those that have a high mission component and lofty goals, is that the needs of the organization are to be satisfied, for the organization to meet its goals, and that's prized more highly than the needs of the individual worker in the organization. That creates a state of dis-ease. As people come to learn experientially that they are useful only to the extent to which they serve the needs of the organization, and when they are no longer providing such service, they're abandoned by it. The real problem for our churches and schools, which tend to put their program, is that they tend to put the programs on the backs of professional church workers. An example of that kind of behavior is our reduction of staff at our little shop called the International Center in St. Louis. People are talking about less staff. And the executive director of our board of directors says, and we will keep the quality of our programs totally intact. What that means is, work harder. Organizations' needs are more important. Don't forget, we're doing a laudable thing. People are asked to work harder and longer and do more, and who can say no when the goals of the organization are so lofty? In our system, money comes around in a similar way. The aforementioned parish to which Barnabas was called, who suggests that the low pay scale is a principal reason for Barnabas' depression, and that he may not have been depressed before he was assigned there? Is it possible that organizations make people sick? Recent study of automobile executives in Michigan indicated that their state of psychiatric hospitalization or psychiatric outpatient and hospitalization utilization of their insurance plans was 37% of the executives. National average is somewhere, really low. Is there something about work habits and things like that that have something to do with whether people are well or sick? How are we caring for people? Ask any one of us what helps us feel good about our workplace, where there are people who have some influence, who care about how I'm doing, how my family is doing, how the work's affecting me. When I first came to the International Center, I got so angry at it that I kept notes. You're never supposed to seek revenge, right? Or keep a little red book with stuff in it. First day, walking down the hall. Hey, Bruce. How's your job going? Fine. Walked on. Later that day, hey, Bruce. How's work look? Fine. Several days, same question. People are interested in me, right? Why am I getting so angry? Remember, holy, holy? Here I am supposed to be smiling, but I'm getting angry when people are giving me good questions, like, how is my work going? Except that on the 15th exchange, I tell you, I counted these, the 15th exchange, somebody asked me what I really needed to hear, which was, how am I doing? Not how's my job, how's the task going, but how am I? It's a real question here moving. It's not easy. How am I doing? How is my spouse feeling about the move? Actually, she was feeling pretty cruddy about it. How do your children feel about our coming back to the Midwest and leaving them on the East Coast? Our grown son said, well, Dad, I'll never be able to come home again. Those are issues that impact me early on when I move, not issues of how my job is going. In the same way that the organization, in this case the church, utilizes people to meet its own goals and in doing so sometimes runs roughshod over the needs of the individual who serve it, also, and this quotes Schief and Fizel, the organization becomes the addictive substance for its employees. Here we go, it works both ways. I've come to a long time to get to this point for you. The organization, or for me, really, the organization becomes the addictive substance for its employees when the employees become hooked on the promise of the mission and choose not to look at how the system is really operating. The grandiosity of the mission is a fix. It can reassure us that we're important and do important work at the same time that it does not take seriously our needs as human beings. The organization becomes the addictive substance for its employees when the employees become hooked on the promise of the mission and choose not to look at how the system is really operating. The grandiosity of a mission of the mission is a fix. In other words, if I see something that's going on that's not healthy, and somebody says to me, but it's the church, the fix is, I say, okay. I either must be crazy, that is, I'm not seeing what's going on, or I just have to leave it alone and don't have anything to say about it. This way of looking at things is reciprocal and interactive. The needs of all organizational church, parish needs, family needs, our own self needs as professional church workers are vital and important. In a healthy environment, the needs of everybody are held in tension. And it's not like everybody's needs get satisfied all the time in every case. But there is an ongoing organizational valuing of task and people that keep that process in tension. In our system of congregational autonomy, it's hard to get that message to our parishes. But when it does get there, everybody feels better. And I wanted to raise that as the second pressure, unnamed pressure, with you in the hopes that should you not be feeling cared for in this way, you might know something of this dynamic and seek ways to be helped to shift it or change it. I also wanted to raise it with you so that you have an opportunity not to perpetuate the pattern with others. As you would wish to be asked, ask people how they're feeling about what they're doing. If they're getting as much out of doing something as they're putting into it, if they need to do their work, what they need to do their work successfully and be joyful and competent and committed. A parish setting is really nice when a board of elders meets with you and asks, Pastor, what do you need to be joyful, competent, and committed in your ministry here? What do you need to become a credible leader? What do you need to be honest and flexible? It will be equally nice and energizing if you ask your volunteers or your teachers or your assistants or associates. Pressure three. There is an old saying that the mind cannot absorb what the rear cannot endure. You want to stretch? Are you doing okay? How much time? Do I have 15 more minutes, right? Okay. Can you hang in with us for 15 more minutes? I can't imagine if you said no, I guess I'd go behind the podium and... Okay. Organizational anxiety, the third unnamed pressure. Tim got into this wonderfully yesterday. I think his non-anxious evangelism was just absolutely spectacular. I just love that. I mean, it's a takeoff from Ed Friedman's non-anxious presence, of course, which, of course, nobody can be anyway, so I don't know why. I mean, but we can strive toward it. The ELCA may not be in trouble, although you're downsizing it a lot, but the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has huge budget shortfalls. Now, a year or so ago, the latest public one was $2 million for ELCA, $1 million for LCMS, and would you believe it, $400,000 for the Wells? Now, for the Wells, $400,000 looks like $5 million to us. This is mirrored in all major denominations and is not a problem exclusive to the LCMS or ELCA. Finances become more stretched because of the economic downturn out of which the country may only be beginning to be emerging and all that kind of business. And certainly the dominance of local and special interest funding. In short, in days of diminished resources, persons will look to what they can see and sometimes lose the vision for supporting what they can't see. But there's also not numerical growth with our church, within our church. So we have kind of a picture, sort of dismalish, I think, that is repeated a lot in our rural parishes and some urban ones and lots of other parishes as well. I don't know about you all, ELCA. We have maybe, 15% of our churches are growing or something like that. But the picture of diminished resources combines with a sense of declining aging numbers and at a human level, anxiety and concern set in about the future of the organization. And the people who are then responsible for organizational life, whether it's a local level or national, get very anxious. And it can set in. National anxiety. Have you ever been flooded by national anxiety? We flood our people regularly with national anxiety. Regional anxiety, or most certainly even local parish anxiety. In this context, people within organizations can get quite anxious when aspects of survival are on the line. Why shouldn't they? Where will we get money to pay for the new roof? Maslow's hierarchy gets going. As people's safety needs and survival needs get going, people get relatively anxious. The issue is not that they shouldn't get anxious. The issue is that we don't recognize it because we're not talking about inner experiences. We're talking at a level elsewhere, as I hope I've shown earlier with us. We need new members who can contribute to pay to the bills, but none that would change the parish, of course. Why aren't we growing, read in numbers, like such and such a parish is? Is there content questions, but are really communications, I think, of underlying anxiety about the survival of the organization, be that national, district, or parish? Undiscussed anxiety motivates all kinds of odd behaviors and creates significant pressure on church workers who tend to become identified as the lightning rod points to receive the anxiety undiscussed of people who are anxious about their organizations. When anxiety is not discussed, odd behaviors emerge and certain characteristics, I think, happen. Among them are, first of all, now this is in a highly anxious but non-discussed environment, empathic connection is reduced. In a highly anxious environment, when people are not discussing what's really going on, empathy between people is reduced. Anxious people tend to ask organizational questions rather than personal ones. And because of a lack of empathy, tend to look for scapegoats to bear the burden to contain their anxiety. If I can find a reason, a person, that's the cause of this, things may not change, but I'll feel better because I have a spot to put my emotions into. As empathy goes down, fault finding goes up. Expect mutual blaming as this escalates. As in our system, the district blames the synod, synod blames congregations, elders blame pastors, pastors blame districts, and any one of 100 other combinations. And all the while, persons are not talking about their underlying anxious concern about organizational survival, about hopelessness in the face of the future, about helplessness to know how to deal with the complex and difficult problems facing us in our world and country. Empathy is reduced. Pressure to raise more resources or do more with less increases. That brings significant pressures to be successful. The children's teeth are set on edge. We end up not being there for each other. The blaming cycle continues. Fault finding is dominant. Lack of positive experience and expectation expands. And church numerical growth becomes normative and expected. Personal growth becomes shortchanged. Organizational survival becomes the dominant mode, couched in theological language. Often the church worker becomes the significant problem carrier because it is to the clergy often that people look to shoulder responsibility, warranted or not. A more healthy way to get at this issue is the monitoring and sharing of issues of anxiety, loss, and change. Committees of committed folk can be formed to provide process and reflection rather than action discharge. as issues are contained, processed, and worked on, rather than simply shunted out to a convenient receptacle. This, of course, requires the development of safety zones and a cultural expectation of sharing as different from discharging. Before I blame somebody or something, I want to first examine how I'm feeling and what my real issues are here. Somebody said, I don't know, it was back, I think it was at this conference, somebody says we need the national church in order to have a receptacle for our anxieties. That is, as long as we can keep the church funded, we can blame them. The development of safety zones and a cultural expectation of sharing as different from discharging, to move from an action discharge mode to a sharing of who I am and where I am and what my experience is a major shift culturally and would alleviate huge pressure on professional church workers, I think. Pastor Priscilla is the only pastor of a parish in a relatively stagnant population area. She came to this parish as a result of a call, having established a reputation as an assertive and make-things-happen person. Now, 4 years later, much is happening, Bible studies, social ministry activities, and the like, but there is not population growth in the parish. Some members of the congregation see an aging congregation and are concerned for its survival. They begin to criticize Pastor Priscilla for not bringing in more members and suggest that it is her rigidity or flexibility, her emphasis on liturgical expression or emphasis on contemporary music, her lack of people skills, or her too close association with a number of new members, or any one of a number of things that are the cause of the problem. This begins to come to a head in a congregational meeting. Pastor Priscilla is hurt, confused, and unsure what to think or do next. What is the issue? Only as persons begin to discuss what's really on their hearts and minds can real progress be made. And can we move from action discharge to a community of sharing wholly, wholly? And part of the conversation must include people's feelings about their parish, possible losses and changes and the like. Any content can be put into the scenario with Pastor Priscilla. The real question is always if she and they can discuss more deeply what is at issue, and can they direct their energy away from blaming each other and finding a receptacle for their feelings to owning what it is their actual experience is and being able to talk about it. That is, working together on a common problem as a result of mutual sharing the collegiality of the body of Christ. So look for issues of concern. Find a person who can help you. Look for issues of underlying concern for yourself as well. And when you get anxious, it's time to talk rather than discharge. I have one more pressure, but I have two more minutes. So I'll just say the other pressure is secularization of the culture and problematic loyalties. You probably know what it is. But the end result is the same thing, which is we treat ourselves as competitors, not as colleagues. Empathy is reduced, competition is up, and everybody becomes an enemy rather than a friend. In that culture, we must have ways to discuss these issues. In those ways, we could have empathic and collegial groups which would help us all move forward, that would break down the barriers of blaming, name-calling, caricaturing, the creating of groups to contain our own anxieties, and the capacity to simply chat about what's really so in our worlds. The greater the gap, the larger the likelihood is of disease, both for individuals and for organizations. The greater the gap in my life, the greater the opportunity is for my disease. The greater the gap in the life of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, that is, the more we say what we don't do or don't talk about what's really going on, the greater the disease, or at least the greater the potential of disease. The more opportunity for holistic expression of who we are, what we're about, in connection with people in the body of Christ, the better opportunity we have to move toward health and resolve some of these pressures that I hoped I've helped name. In this time with you, I've tried to identify a pressure, a health vulnerability, and suggested some alternatives that might alleviate the pressure. I've attempted to avoid blame, but rather establish a context for reflection and processing. I hope I've been successful, but of course, I'm also a fallen human being, quite ambivalent too, and I may have communicated some things that only you know I communicated, and if you give me feedback, I might learn something about where I'm at too. But I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. And in the words of St. John, dear friend, I pray that you may enjoy good health and that all may go well with you, even as your soul is getting along well. Thank you very much.